morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to try to explain why these things have happened and what it means to you and me. During our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through His Torah, which means teaching, not law, and by way of His covenant, a relationship which features five conditions that not one in a million people is even aware of. If you're an atheist, an agnostic, or just someone who knows that there's something not quite right with your religion, this will be the best part of each day's program. Our phone number, should you like to question, to criticize, or to affirm anything I may have to say today, is 877-300-7645. First item in the news today is a story that appeared this week out of Baghdad. It was filed by the Associated Press. Now, the reason the Associated Press should mean something to you, and normally I don't provide the name of the news source, is because the Associated Press is owned almost exclusively now by Islamic interest. It was purchased by the oil-rich chieftains over the Middle Eastern fiefdoms. This story begins. A startling spasm of violence shook more than a dozen Iraqi cities, killing over 110 people in coordinated bombings and shootings, wounding twice as many in the country's deadliest day in more than 2 years. So more than twice as many, actually, the number was over 350, that would be over three times as many people that were killed, were badly wounded by these bomb blasts. And it was not the least bit startling. This has been ongoing ever since we invaded Iraq. By we, I'm an American, we're speaking from America. Prior to Saddam Hussein's ouster, terrorist attacks in Iraq were extraordinarily rare. They occurred on average of a couple of times per year. They were usually small in scale, typically 2 to 4 people succumbing to a terrorist attack. And as I said, they occurred about once every 6 months. Now in Iraq, they occur every day. Some days are extraordinarily deadly, like this one, with over 450 people either being killed or maimed. There is nothing startling about this at all. In fact, suicide bombings and these kinds of attacks are extraordinarily common in countries where Muslims dominate the population. What this article says next, however, is misleading. And the authors of the story know that it's misleading, as well as do the fiefdoms which employ them. It reads, "The attacks came only days after Al-Qaeda announced that it would attempt a comeback with a new offensive against Iraq's weakened government." But here's what's misleading about that. Al-Qaeda didn't exist in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion. There was absolutely no Al-Qaeda presence of any kind in Iraq until almost a year after the U.S. invaded. And the reason for that is that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda's founder, if you pull out the United States for a moment, and you just deal with the reality that Al-Qaeda had as its religious founder, Osama bin Laden, they were archenemies. In fact, Osama bin Laden wanted the honor of pushing Saddam Hussein, who he considered to be an infidel, out of Saudi Arabia. And when he was turned down by the Saudi Arabian government because they didn't think they could control him as easily as they could control the United States and George Bush, the Sauds felt that America would be a better choice for pushing Saddam Hussein and his Iraqis out of Kuwait and keeping them from invading Saudi Arabia, principally because they thought that we'd be easier to control than would be these fundamentalist Muslims. Now, the case that the Muslims made for their ability to fight Saddam Hussein was the fact that they had successfully, with the United States armament and with United States funding, defeated the Soviets in Afghanistan. So they said, hey, if we can defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan, we can most certainly defeat Saddam Hussein, and our battle against Saddam Hussein will be Muslims against infidels, because Saddam Hussein was not considered to be a Muslim by good Muslims. Now, the other part of this al-Qaeda reference that is inappropriate. So first, you know, al-Qaeda didn't even exist in Iraq when the United States invaded. So George Bush, when he said that's one of the reasons that we have to go into Iraq, he knowingly and purposefully lied to the American people. The second aspect of this is that the al-Qaeda that exists now in Iraq has absolutely no association of any kind with the al-Qaeda that has been wrongly associated with 9/11. So by using the term al-Qaeda, we're creating a misnomer and a misimpression. And you might say, who cares, you know, it's just all bad guys. What do we care what they're called? That is the primary issue. If you don't know who is doing what to whom and why they're doing it, then there's really no way to understand even anything that's happening in the world. So it's essential that you know that the al-Qaeda references here are completely misleading. There is no association between the al-Qaeda that Osama bin Laden was associated with and the al-Qaeda in Iraq today. If you want to understand the world of Islamic terrorism, it really all boils down into two cesspools, if you will. On one side, you have the Shia Muslims. Now, Shia Muslims only represent about 10% to 15% of Muslims worldwide, but the issue with the Shias is they are typically more fundamentalist than Sunni Muslims as a whole, and the more fundamentalist the Muslim, the better the Muslim, the more the Muslim is going to be a terrorist. It is impossible to be a good Muslim and not be a terrorist. There's lots of bad Muslims who are good people, but the only way to be a Muslim and a good person, the only way to be a Muslim and a peaceful person, is to be a bad Muslim. So, as it relates to al-Qaeda and what's going on in Iraq with these suicide bombings, rather than referencing this al-Qaeda, which is essentially gone and never was much of anything, what we have here is Sunni fundamentalists fighting and trying to kill Shia Muslims. The Shia Muslim terrorist organization is Hezbollah. It means Allah's party. It was created in Tehran by the mullahs. Its headquarters is in Damascus, Syria. And in future programs, we're going to talk about the role that Hezbollah has not played and yet will ultimately play, if necessary, in the civil war that's taking place in Syria and what it means to us going forward in terms of this part of the world. But in Iraq, when the United States invaded Iraq and gave Iraq to the government of Iran, which is essentially what we did, then you had disempowered Sunni Muslims who were lashing out at empowered Shia Muslims. In Iraq, the name of the Shia terrorist group is the Mahdi Brigade. The Mahdi is this long-hoped-for messiah of the Islamic world who will be a warlord, who is said to rally all of the Islamic world into one caliphate so that they, in unison, can attack Israel and accomplish what Muhammad wanted to do, which was to kill every Jew and destroy the country of Israel. So that is the what is happening here. And if we were to label these people as Shia fundamentalists and therefore Mahdi Brigaders or Hezbollah or Sunni fundamentalists, and therefore you can use the primary term that Muslims will use, which is a Salafist. We saw that in Egypt about 25% of the total vote in the Egyptian elections went to the Salafist. They are Muslims even more fundamentalist than the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a Salafist organization. Salafist means ancestor in Arabic, and that means that Salafists follow the teachings that came from Muhammad and from Muhammad's companions. This would mean that they value the hadith, and the hadith are sayings from Muhammad's that chronicle Muhammad's words and deeds. For those interested in knowing what these things are, so that you understand the mindset of the Wahhabis, which is a Salafist Islamic organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Salafists in Egypt, or these fundamentalist Muslims parading under the name Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the misnomer Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I would encourage you to read Prophet of Doom. Prophetofdoom.net will take you there. It is the most comprehensive, best documented presentation of the Islamic hadith that is the basis of the religious beliefs of the Sunni and Shia Muslim terrorists. They share the same basic documents. All right, so now you understand what's happening in Iraq. You've got fundamentalist Shia Muslims, and you've got brigades of armed and deadly Shia Muslims against Sunni Muslims. They're vying for power. This is exactly what's happening in Syria. The civil war in Syria is Saudi Arabia, which is Sunni, providing arms and money to the Sunni Muslims who are rebelling against the Alawite, which is a Shia government in Syria, which is backed by Iran, and via Iran also China and Russia that have business ties with Iran. Now, this article goes on to say, and so we had a caller, Moshe, was calling in and wanted to talk about the President of the United States, but was somehow disconnected. With the U.S. military gone, this article reads, and the government mired in infighting, the Iraqi wing of Al-Qaeda has vowed to retake areas it once controlled and push the nation back towards civil war. Once again, no truth in journalism. Yes, the U.S. military is gone. The government isn't mired in infighting. There really is no government in Iraq. All you have in Iraq is the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani and Sattar, the two leading Muslim clerics, both of whom are Iranian, controlling the existing government, which is a puppet of their Iranian version of Shia Islam. And the Sunni Muslims, which represent about a third of the population, have opted out because they have absolutely no say in this pseudo-government.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. If you'd like to call this program, our number is 877-300-7645. Well, I apologize for the way we ended the last segment of the program. We had a technical glitch. And your host did not hear was unable to hear the music that normally leads into a commercial break. So I apologize for that and for stepping on the message of one of our sponsors. The thing we were talking about at the end of the last segment was that there's this, in this article, it says that, and this is from the Associated Press out of Baghdad, that there is infighting in the government and that the Al-Qaeda wing in Iraq has vowed to retake areas it's once controlled and to push the nation back into civil war. The reality is, as we have found, there is no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, not one that is in any ways associated with the Al-Qaeda that was wrongly associated with 9/11. This notion that the government is mired in infighting kind of sounds like the squabbles between Republicans and Democrats when we have gridlock in the U.S. That is not the case here. The Kurds are not participating in the government. They have essentially created their own state in northern Iraq, and they have said, we won't bother you, you don't bother us, we'll just opt out, y'all, you have a nice life. And the Sunnis that are intermixed at the rate of about one-third, two-thirds, they represent about one-third of Iraq, have decided that there's no reason for their contingency to vote because every bit of power in Iraq is controlled by the Shia Muslim. It would have been eminently smarter for America had we gone in and said, Kurds, you can have your own country. We told them the opposite. They defied America. Shias, you want to become part of Iran, we understand. Go ahead and do that, because that's what's happened. And Sunnis, why don't you carve out your own country? And we can avoid all of this ongoing bloodshed, or we could have avoided invading Iraq in the first place and been a whole lot better off. But we did not do that, and so we have left an absolute mess in that country. This article goes on to say there was no immediate claim of responsibility for Monday's attacks. Nearly all of them struck the capital in northern Iraq, where al-Raqi can most easily regain a foothold. And the reason for that is there's a lot more influence of the old regime of Sunnis in Iraq, around Baghdad, than there is in any other place around the country. Now, this goes on. It says, quote, terrorists are opening another gate of hell for us. This is from Karmiran Karim, a sweets seller in northern Iraq. And he was hit by five exploding cars in the vicinity of his sweet shop. I always find it interesting that in these articles, to get local flavor, they interview street merchants, which is what this fellow is. But in this particular case, the street merchant had it right. He said, the terrorists are opening another gate of hell for us. Those who really study Islam, which is something I've done, I've invested 10,000 hours in the study of Islam. I've written the most comprehensive book on the original documents which chronicle Muhammad's words and deeds, and I am among the few in the history of the last 1,400 years since Islam was invented to actually put the Quran in chronological order and to set it into the context of Muhammad's life by way of the Hadith. And so I've got a pretty good understanding of Islam and of particularly of Muhammad. To say that that the fundamentalist Muslims are opening the gates of hell is an appropriate statement. Islam is incompatible with humanity living in peace. Islam is a declaration of war against all humankind. When Yahweh spoke of what would be come Muslims, Ishmael, the descendants of Ishmael, he says specifically, they have raised, their hands will be raised against their brother's hand against them. We're talking now about the Sunni-Shia conflict, which is 14 centuries old, and they will live in hostility with the whole world. This conflict that we're witnessing will continue to bubble up until the world of Islam is, for at least a moment, unified in its unified hatred of Israel. The Quran, for those who do not know, is a more anti-Semitic book than Hitler's Mein Kampf. In fact, in Prophet of Doom, I take 77 pages of the book are devoted to setting Hitler's statements in Mein Kampf directly beside Muhammad's statements in the Quran and Hadith. And because Islam is fundamentally anti-Semitic, Muslims will continue to rally around anyone who threatens the destruction of Israel. Well, this is time for our next break. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the break. Thank you for listening. Well, good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths. Should you wish to call the program, our number is 877-300-7645. There was a call who was disconnected, but my producer, Scott, has told me that the caller's question was really just, rather than making a statement, he wanted to know, was the President of the United States a Muslim, and therefore could we understand some of the malfeasance that the United States seems to be involved in the Islamic world, a result of Barack Hussein Obama being a Muslim? My answer to that question is I don't think Barack Hussein Obama is a Muslim. His father was a Muslim. He was certainly in his youth educated in madrasas, which are Islamic schools. And by the Islamic definition, having a Muslim father and being raised in Muslim schools, he would be a Muslim. In fact, if Barack Hussein Obama lived in an Islamic country and made the statement that he has, that he says that he is not a Muslim, that he claims to be a Christian, they would kill him. The fourth surah of the Quran says that if a Muslim rejects his faith, you must kill him. And by the Islamic definition of what is a Muslim, Barack Hussein Obama is a Muslim. By our definition, in terms of what religion does someone ascribe to, he's not. Now, that is also, it would also be untrue to say that Barack Obama is a Christian. To claim to be a Christian because you attended Reverend Wright's sermons and you attended his church does not qualify by any rational definition of Christianity. Reverend Wright uses the name of Christian to launch a revolution of anti-Semitism. He is a very evil and misguided man. My conclusion with Barack Hussein Obama is that he is a secular humanist, that he has ascribed to the national religion of America, the religion of American education and the media, the religion of American politics, which is socialist secular humanism. My feeling also is that the anti-Masiyah, known as the Antichrist, will mirror Obama's kind of upbringing in the sense that his mother will in all likelihood be a Catholic or at least an Orthodox Christian. His father will in all likelihood be a Muslim, and he will in all likelihood be raised through socialist secular institutions, will probably have attended and may already have graduated from a school like Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, or Yale, and therefore be a socialist secular humanist. I made a comment in the previous segment of the show where I said that it is impossible to be a good Muslim and not be a terrorist, that all good Muslims are terrorists. My producer during the break said, you know, how is that possible? And let me explain it to you. According to the Quran, in the ninth surah of the Quran, which was the second to last surah handed down, Muhammad had overhunted Jews. There were no more Jews to attack and to rob, to enslave and to rape within camel's ride of Medina, of Yathrib in Saudi Arabia. And so he turned his sights on the Byzantines, which was a Christian, Roman Catholic Christian empire. He not only changed his enemy from speaking most vociferously against Jews and made the primary enemy Christians, in that switch, because the Muslims that first followed Muhammad said, hey, you know, the Jews are easy to attack. They're farmers. They don't put up a good fight. They're easy to kill. They're close by. They don't have an army. And it's cool that we fight them as terrorists because we're the only ones with arms and they don't have any weapons. And so they're easy to rob, to kill, to enslave. But they said, you know, these Byzantines now, they have an army. We ought not be going after the Byzantines because they'll clean our clock. We don't want to do that. And so in the ninth surah, Muhammad begins this whole tirade against non-jihadists. And he says that if you're a peaceful Muslim, if you're not engaged in jihad, then you cease to be a Muslim. Now, this is supposed to be Allah speaking, so excuse me for pretending like it was actually Muhammad. But the claim was made throughout the ninth surah that a Muslim that does not engage in jihad, which is not a spiritual struggle, is fighting with full arms and weaponry against Islam's enemy, which would include anyone who doesn't surrender to Allah and doesn't become a Muslim, that they were called hypocrites. So any Muslim, according to the Quran now, who does not engage in a terrorist activity as a jihadist, ceases to be a Muslim and becomes a hypocrite. The Quran then tells the jihadist fundamentalist Muslims to kill them because Allah says that he wants to personally torture the peaceful Muslims in the hottest places in hell. So if you are a bad Muslim, you are a peaceful Muslim, you're in a real pickle. Because your God hates you. And therefore, peaceful Muslims have no say and no influence in Islam. They're hated by good Muslims, and their God in particular hates them. Now, if you're a Muslim listening to this and you say, that can't be true, then you need to go and read Prophet of Doom. Now, the reason I say read Prophet of Doom as opposed to just picking up your Quran is that while the Quran actually says all of these things to you, and it is very clear. It is even clearer when you set the Quran in chronological order outside of the jumbled mess that it's currently in and rearrange the Quran so that you can set it into the context of Muhammad's life, so that you understand the context under which the ninth surah of the Quran was handed down in this transition of fighting between from terrorist attacks on Jews to launching terrorist attacks on outskirts of the Byzantine Empire. And you will understand that what I'm telling you is absolutely correct. Now, it's interesting that that when I shared that during the break with my producer, with Scott, his first comment was, well, that being the case and it being so clear, why is anyone a Muslim? And what I had to share with him is the fact that with most religious people, evidence and reason don't matter. That I don't care if the religion is Christianity or it is Islam or it is Hinduism. It does not matter the religion. Religion is about faith. It's about belief. Faith and belief are the antithesis of knowing and understanding. So if somebody presents irrefutable evidence that demonstrates that the religion is wrong, that it is not trustworthy, as I will do in this program regarding Islam and Christianity and Judaism, that if the religious individual is universally incapable of processing it, even if the evidence comes and is a direct quote from the individual they claim to be their God, and that quote totally and completely refutes their religion, as is the case with Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, the religious person is incapable of even processing that information. So that's how they deal with evidence and reason like this. Now, it was interesting that in the end of our program yesterday, and we're unable to get him to call back, but we were hoping that we were going to get a phone call from a gentleman named Nick. He is a Muslim in Wisconsin. And what he told Scott, and the point that he wanted to make at the end of our program on Friday of last week, we asked him to call back today in this segment of the show, because we were down to our last 3 minutes on Friday, was that the killings that are being perpetrated under the name of Allah aren't motivated through the Islamic religion. They don't come from the Quran and Hadith, but they instead are all coming from the local imam. So the imam, according to Nick, is misleading these young boys and beguiling them into becoming a jihadist when their religion itself does not condone such activity. So I was going to ask Nick, should he have called in. I said, Nick, let me see if I understand your proposition. Your proposition is that the imam, which is the best educated Muslim in the community, the one that has gone to school to study the Quran and Hadith, that is the authoritative voice of Islam in the community, is lying to the young men and women in the Islamic congregation. And that it's not isolated cases, since there happen to be hundreds of thousands of Islamic jihadists around the world perpetrating acts of terrorism. So that you're saying that there are hundreds of thousands of the best educated Muslims in the world who are universally lying to young Muslim men and women and telling them to be jihadists when the religion itself says the opposite. Is that your proposition? And if so, Nick, what's wrong with that picture? If the best educated, most fundamentalist, most true Muslims are lying on behalf of the religion, is there not a problem in the religion? Now, as it turns out, lying happens to be a good thing in Islam. In the ninth surah, it actually begins by announcing a lie and giving Muslims the authority to lie. You see, Muhammad had signed a peace accord with Mecca saying that he would not terrorize the Meccans for 10 years. He wouldn't kidnap them. He wouldn't promote terrorist raids against their caravans. He would stop all of these things. And so the Quran then announces that any agreement between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is no longer valid, including anything that Muhammad himself were to pledge. Well, I'm told we actually have Nick having called in. So I'm going to bring Nick on the air. I'm going to ask Nick this question. He was obviously listening. So, Nick, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
All right. So let me ask you this question, Nick. Your proposition, is it not, is that the imams are misleading Muslims, causing them to be jihadists when the religion itself does not condone acts of terrorism. Is that your proposition, Nick?
I'll answer your question in a second. First, I need to clarify that I'm not a Muslim. I'm not a, well, I used to be a Christian, but those guys on the Muslim side showed me so many of the bad things in the Bible that now I'm like, don't believe in anything or don't know yet what to believe to. And yes, you're I would agree with what you're saying in most of the aspects, but the were the imams telling to their Muslims is that when they do go and commit those acts of terror, they're not actually killing the peaceful.
Nick, can you hold on past the break? We'll pick you up on the other side of the commercial break. Looking forward to hearing from you, Nick. Thank you. Mm-hmm. This is Shattering Myths, 877-300-7645. Good morning and welcome back to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. Nick has been kind enough to hold over during the break. I'm going to get right back to Nick here in a moment. The thing that I wanted to share before we get back to Nick is that he did make a statement that is very encouraging. What Nick said is that he was a Muslim. He's no longer a Muslim. He was for a while there, may have been a Christian, but he saw some things that that Muslims pointed out about Christianity and that he doesn't now know what to believe. There is nothing that I would like more than for people in Nick's position to listen to this program. During the break, I was talking to my producer, Scott, about that very topic, which is that this program is specifically designed for those of you who are open enough to say, I'm not really sure what to believe, because the answer to that is don't believe anything. Stop entirely. If you can get to the position where you're saying, you know, there's so much wrong in Christianity, and we're going to talk about those things. There's so much wrong in Islam. There's so much wrong in socialist secular humanism. We should not place our belief or trust in those institutions. The same thing is true. There's so much wrong with what countries like the United States are doing around the world, like making a bad situation worse by invading countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. There's so much wrong that is being done by governments. We should not put our trust or faith in them either, which is kind of interesting because the first thing that Yahweh, which is the name of God's one and only name, the very first thing he asks us to do, if you want to have a relationship with him, want to engage in the covenant, is to walk away from religion, walk away from your politics, walk away from your patriotism, walk away from your religion, and once you have shown a willingness to do that, he's willing to engage with you. So, Nick, the first thing is I owe you an apology. When I read the little one-line snippet at the end of the program yesterday, I think I accurately stated what was written there, but I assumed that you were a Muslim. You're not a Muslim. Is that correct?
No, I used to be a Christian. I'm not anymore, but I was never Muslim, and the reason why I'm interested in the Islam is because my niece just got, well, not just, but like about five, six years already, she's married to a Muslim.
Okay.
And I know that those guys are not the bad people, and I just got, you know, God, why, I just want to know why do people thinking that Muslims are bad. But so that's why I wanted to know more about that religion. And
okay,
I have one question though.
Sure.
Concerning that religion, I know I discovered mm-hmm. that Muhammad got married at a girl. His favorite wife was 9 years old. Mm-hmm. But from what I hear from the Muslims is that mm-hmm. he married to her not for sex, but for some other moral stance, where he wants to grow a perfect wife and for her not to be, you know, to be exposed to anything
Nick,
from their point of view. And so my question is, well, they say that, but surely we don't know if we can believe it or not. I want to know how old was his favorite wife when she had the first child, because that would be for sure, you know, it would for sure tell me how old was she.
Nick, let me answer your question, and it happens to be a very good question. And what I'm going to encourage you to do, Nick, is to do two things. One, I want you to listen to this program going forward, and second, I want you to go to prophetofdoom.net. It's the most comprehensive book ever, best documented book ever written about Muhammad, his words and deeds, in addition to presenting the Quran in the context of Muhammad's life. Muhammad was 50 years old when he married Aisha. She was 6 years old at the time. He is said to have consummated his marriage, have sex with Aisha, when she was 9 years old and he was 53. Muhammad built the mosque of Yathrib, today's Medina, not as a building that you would envision as a mosque, but instead as a brothel, where all of the apartments for all of his sex toys were all around this square. And so, unfortunately, we have the music coming in, and so this is the end of this section of the program. I'm going to return to this topic, though, Nick, and if you want to stay on the line, I will continue on this topic for a few minutes into our second hour of Shattering Myths. But I can prove it's absolutely that Muhammad was a pedophile, and there is no way to justify being a pedophile. This is Shattering Myths, 877-300-7645.